KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A recent landmark study by the General Social Survey has tracked Americans' mood since 1972. Along with a number of other studies on happiness, it reveals that over recent years, women appear to be more unhappy, while the opposite appears to be true of men. What are we to make of these longitudinal trends, especially in light of the fact that women over the past 3.5 decades have made dramatic gains in employment, politics, and education? We grapple with the implications of the gender unhappiness gap and what it means in the hour ahead with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. A number of recent studies point to a paradox about the sexes and happiness. Though quality of life and opportunities of advance for women they have overall, nevertheless become subjectively increasingly unhappy. In the 70s, women had a higher happiness ratio than men, while now it appears, according to these studies, to have been reversed. What accounts for this phenomenon and what does it portend? Well, in this forum hour, we're going to look at the happiness gender gap. And joining us for the hour, Betsy Stevenson, who is Assistant Professor of Business and Public Policy at the Wharton School of Business and co-author of a more recent study, Paradox of Declining Female Happiness. She joins us by phone from Philadelphia. We welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
We also want to welcome Ruth Rosen, Professor of History at UC Berkeley, former columnist with the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, who is with us this morning from Berkeley. Welcome, Ruth Rosen.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And in studio, we want to welcome Christine Carter, who is Executive Director of the Greater Good Science Center, author of Raising Happiness, which will be out from Random House in January. And the Greater Good Science Center will be hosting a special day-long event at UC Berkeley. We'll tell you more about that in the course of this program. But we want to welcome Christine Carter. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Betsy Stevenson, let me begin with you, and let's just get a sense of this study, because it's pervasive as far as demographic groups and crosses all age groups, class, mental state, status of all kinds, really, with or without children. The only difference being African-American women, who are slightly happier, but less so than African-American men. So tell us a little bit about how, first of all, you gleaned this information.
Was we started with data from the General Social Survey, which is a data set that's widely used to assess Americans' happiness, because this question about how happy are you, and in fact the exact question is, taken all things together these days, would you say you're very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy, has been asked in a very similar way most years since 1972. And what we found when we analyzed that data set is, if you look in the early 70s, women on average had happiness ratings that were higher than those of men, but that women had becoming less happy very consistently over time. It was a very broad trend. And we found this, of course, very puzzling, because this is a period of time where legal and social rights have been extended to women. So the next thing we did was looked at a bunch of these other data sets, these other studies that you mentioned, looking at data from Monitoring the Future data set, that Virginia Slims poll, and then even international data. And we found the same thing in every data set that we looked at, that women had become less happy over time relative to that of men. And in many cases, this involved women becoming less happy, women starting the period happier than men and ending the period less happy than men.
And men become happier. And a lot of this turns for women around the age of 47.
Well, so we're looking at those are two very different phenomenon. Now, they're interesting to consider together, but we're looking at changes over time. So what's happened over the last 35 years? And that is true whether we're looking at 17-year-olds. We find that 17-year-old girls are telling us that they're happier than 17-year-old boys in the 1970s, and by the end of the by the 2000s, they're telling us they're less happy than what these 17-year-old boys are saying. It's happening across the life cycle, as you said, across socio and economic in different demographic groups. But there's a different phenomenon that was discovered by Richard Easterlin and his co-author, which is that if you look over a life cycle at any given point in time, it looks like women become less happy over their lifetime. And that leads to that turning point that you just mentioned.
There was a study out of Cambridge. Richard Easterlin is at USC, but his partner, Anka Plagol, I believe the name is pronounced, is at Cambridge University. Let's get a sense, though, of what's going on here. I mean, it just seems so paradoxical, as you suggested. We can remember Betty Friedan and the Feminine Mystique saying women are unhappy because they have to fulfill this role as wife mothers and they can't be free, and now they can pretty much have the choice of doing whatever they want, then maybe that choice has created more anxiety or more difficulties?
Well, that's certainly something that's possible. What we find, looking at the data, is that there's not a very simple answer that comes out of the data. And this, of course, is makes for great conversation because there's all sorts of hypotheses that we can neither confirm nor reject if you look at the data. I mean, one possibility is that the other thing Betty Friedan said is that women weren't speaking about this problem. It was the problem that had no name. And so perhaps women were exaggerating their happiness in the 70s, and they've just become more honest about their feelings over time. So we might think that what we've had is a great deflation in happiness reporting. So it's all still correlated with how people truly feel, but now they're just being a little bit more honest, and there hasn't been any real change in their underlying attitudes.
There is a sense, I guess, from your perspective, this may have to do also with cultural changes, the whole bowling alone phenomenon that we've read about and heard about.
It's certainly possible that social trends don't impact each group similarly. And so there's been lots of social trends over the last 35 years that don't just have to do with women. And it could be that it's those social trends that have made women less happy while making men happier than women.
Betsy Stevenson, again with us from Philadelphia, is with the Wharton School of Business. She's assistant professor of business and public policy and also co-author of the study Paradox of Declining Female Happiness. Christine Carter, again, is executive director of Greater Good Science Center and the author of Raising Happiness. Well, it's guaranteed to Americans, Christine Carter, this pursuit of happiness. Why are women, why is it more elusive for women?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that are happening, and you were pointing to this cultural change. I think that there's so many things here that I have hypotheses about what might be happening. And I doubt actually that it's a deflation. I think that we have seen really big changes for women, and that it points to this paradox of choice. Women have a lot more choices now, but we've learned from Barry Schwartz's research that choice is not necessarily the thing that is going to make us most happy. So
more choice means more anxiety, perhaps?
Well, it can. It can. There can be a real discrepancy between women's aspirations and what they or their expectations about what their life will be like and what they actually their life is actually like. So girls grow up learning that they can do anything, and they really are facing what Steve Hinshaw has called a triple bind. They're expected to be and told that they can be terrific mothers and have these really rich, fulfilling family lives and these really rich, fulfilling work life. And they have – that's the double bind. The triple bind is that there is no other alternate model of doing all of these things not necessarily perfectly high achieving in every single realm sets up an expectation that maybe is not entirely realistic, that can lead to all kinds of anxiety, I think, for women.
So despite the progress and advancements from the women's movement, is it safe to say that expectations have been inflated to such a great degree that they can't possibly be met, and that's that gap is what we're talking about here in the gender gap?
Well, I think that that's one of several factors probably that that our expectations have been inflated about what it is we can do and achieve in all these different realms of life, and that that busyness, that doing trying to do everything intensely and perfectly has, and that achievement in and of itself leads to choices which don't necessarily make us happy. So we know that some of the big factors that make us happy in life are social connections, for one, in one way. And I think that other researchers have shown that we have really seen a decline in the strength of our social connections over time. And that so you can kind of see all of these things start to work together. Women become more and more busy. And they might have more friends in more realms, but those relationships are less intense. Maybe the connections are weakening here and there. They're running from one thing to the next.
Less of a feeling of community, higher aspirations, and maybe even more of a feeling of entitlement, paradoxically.
Yes. Well, I think that's the entitlement is a really interesting thing, that we have a paradox also around abundance. So when you have a lot and you expect a lot, you're much more likely to feel entitled to that and to feel disappointed when you don't get what you want. So when you expect to have a successful career and to get married and have kids and be able to be involved in your kids' life in a really intense way and have all of these things at once, and you can't, you find that you can't do all those things as well as you want to, you feel disappointed.
You also find that you have a second shift in many cases, although this, as we said, covers all both married women, women with children, without children, although the most unhappy women are apparently the women with children, which is disturbing.
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about, though, that that instead of feeling grateful when you get something that you thought that you couldn't have, you feel this real disappointment that you thought that you could have a full-time career and be, you know, rocket to the top, and you thought that you could have children and spend tons of time with your kids. It's the kids that I think nobody regrets having kids, but consistently across studies, you do see that people with children are the ones that are, tend to be struggling the most, because it creates stress in your life and an inability to maybe do all that you thought that you were going to do.
Well, talk about kids. Let's bring Ruth Rosen into this, who's a professor of history at UC Berkeley and former columnist of the LA Times and San Francisco Chronicle. One of these studies found out that girls in the high school level said everything seems to be getting more important. That may be true about both genders, but also it's come through in a lot of these studies, Ruth Rosen, that girls are much harder on themselves, too. And one has to ask, what's this all about?
Well, when I wrote the book, and I just got hoarse. When I wrote the book, The World Split Open, which was about the history of the women's movement, I concluded very early, even when I was studying it in the 70s, I concluded very early that the women's movement was not the group that was saying, you can have it all. It was journalists, it was sloppy feature articles in women's magazines, that the women's movement was saying, we have to change society, we have to alter institutional arrangements and economic arrangements so that you don't get it all without doing it all. That's not the purpose of the women's movement. The purpose is to change society, not to have you become a pretzel and change yourself to fit into society. And I've been teaching since 72, so in a way, I've been watching this change of young people, as you say, high school students, who have changed so much. But in 72, they were almost euphoric at the possibility of having it all, because there were so many books and so many articles that said, well, you can have it all. You can. It's just possible. But in fact, that's not what was coming out of the women's movement. The women's movement was saying, no, you're not supposed to do it all to have it all. The society is supposed to change. And what that meant was, very specifically, one was the government was supposed to change. There was supposed to be subsidized for child care, for welfare, for health care. And was also supposed to be, men were supposed to be equally involved in parenting. And so if you have a society where the women's lives have changed, but the institutional organizations, for the most part, yes, a few corporations have changed, but for the most part, you don't have a real change in society, how could women not be more unhappy? How could they not be more disappointed?
We are seeing more parity, though. I mean, every study points out to the fact that as far as men, at least the division of labor is more involving men than it ever has been in the past.
Well, there's no question. Men are doing more. But what's interesting to me between 1972 and today, just as of yesterday, the students I have seen about the age of 17 and 18 and 19 feel increasingly and growingly anxious about how they're going to, quote-unquote, have it all. And since they were not there, they were born way after the movement began, they really do assume this is their problem. that it's their individual problem to which they have to have and find an individual solution. And when, like Arlie Hochschild's book, for example, The Second Shift, or The Time Bind, the fact that women have so much less time, all of that is a surprise to them, that this is this. Oh, I didn't realize this was supposed to be different. I mean, they have really not had the experience of knowing that this is not supposed to be just their individual problem, that it's supposed to be a problem that is a collective problem and is supposed to be changed as a collective problem.
I understand what you're saying about the importance of systemic change and institutional change. But as I was thinking about this, it occurred to me, especially when you see World Health Organization statistics about women becoming more depressed, second worst debilitating disease for women. It's the number 10 debilitating disease for men. Women medicating themselves two times as much as men. Well, some of that can be attributed to the fact that maybe men hide their feelings more behind stoic masks and the like. But it occurred to me that maybe there's just too much emphasis still on looks and women getting older and women feeling, you know, that they have to keep up with the standards of physical beauty and all that. I mean, eating disorders, all these things seem to stem from a lot of that.
Eating disorders and the age 47 that was mentioned is not
exactly
an accident.
Yeah.
It's also important, you know, I'm as a historian, not a sociologist. If you look back at the women who went to college or who wrote books about the second-class citizenship of women in American society, those women were unhappy. And they would have described themselves in these studies as unhappy because they felt that they deserved to have equality, and they deserved a parity and custody of their children. They had so many grievances, is what I'm suggesting. And whereas the women who were not part of any movement or writing or educated, they were not the ones who would have described themselves as unhappy. And finally, I just want to say one other thing, and I think that has to do with the women who came out of the women's movement, many of whom were fleeing from the iconic image of the housewife. And when you look at women who were in their 20s or in their 30s, who are now 20, 30 years older, many of them, that's not what they're fleeing from. They're fleeing many times from the image they have of working women who are also mothers, who are absolutely unhappy, divorced, can't get married again, too old, and feel as though they've wasted their life. And they also see their mothers very unhappy, just as my generation looked at their mothers, even if they weren't, in fact, just housewives. They looked at the iconic image of what Betty Friedan wrote about. These are two different, what I'm saying is these are two different problems, and they have two different names.
Again, Ruth Rosen is professor of history at UC Berkeley, and I mentioned her book again, The World Split Open. Let me go to the co-author of the study, Betsy Stevenson, once more. You've sort of put a caveat out here, Betsy Stevenson, that we need to be cautious about how this data is used. What do you mean exactly?
Let me, the teenage girls, that was actually our research, and so I wanted to just comment a little bit on that, which is I do think that they are pointing to something we need to think about, which is it's not just that they're telling us that that everything's becoming more important to them, and I think they're telling us that making a contribution in society, being a leader in their community is more important, that family's more important, that work's more important, that being successful in their career. So everything's becoming more important to them. And when we're asked, when they're then asked how satisfied are they with their life across a number of domains, the one area in which they consistently say that they've become less satisfied is their time for doing things that they want, time for fun, their leisure time. So it seems like what these are, 17-year-old girls who aren't feeling yet the pressure of balancing a family and a career. They're still pushing aside time for just hanging out and having fun because they feel that they need to achieve. And, I think that is something we should think about for the whole, for all women, but it's certainly something that's a lot bigger than saying, well, we need to just restrict choices or that it's just about those years when women have a career and children. There seems to be something, people are wrestling with how they want to allocate time in their life to live the best life they can. How do they allocate it across family, career, community? And I think men are wrestling with that as well, but the big change over time has been that women are really confronting this on a daily basis. But it is possible that what we're seeing is this, as I said, a phenomenon, a deflation. And I want to say one fact that supports the idea that women aren't getting less happy, which is that the suicide rates have fallen. Suicide rates rose to the 50s and 60s and started falling for women in the 70s. And they've been falling both absolutely and relative to that of men. And that is sort of confusing when we then look at the fact that women take antidepressants more than men. But yet the fall in suicide that we saw when the new form of antidepressants were introduced in the late 80s only happened among men, that in fact suicide has been stable for women over about the last 15, 20 years. And the big fall in suicide happened in the 70s and 80s for women.
Well, that's hopeful and good to hear. Christine Carter, women are generally harder on themselves, though. I mean, in fact, somebody was joking to me and saying, well, you know what the reason is behind this decline in happiness in women. It's the difficulty of finding good men these days. But we won't even go there. But seriously, they tend to, I mean, just in terms of self-esteem and all that, be tougher on themselves.
Yeah, well, I think that that probably is true in some ways, particularly when you look within specific domains like parenting. We were talking about how men actually have become more involved, but their involvement, they tend to experience their involvement differently in the sense that they judge themselves as good fathers in a different way. You know, we're seeing this generation of mothers is very hard on themselves. They're very intensely involved with their children, or they can be. Certainly, educated mothers today tend to get quickly labeled as helicopter parents, or there's sort of the phenomenon of teacup parenting. And
lingo. You talk about the oxygen mask, for example.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a whole other thing that we can see from the research is starting with teenagers, in the sense that people aren't setting aside the time that they need to take care of themselves. So if what's growing in importance to people is all these other things, aside from things like, you know, play and relaxation, that's just sort of upping the stress level. And so that the oxygen mask is what, you know, the need to put your own oxygen mask on first, I think, is a really useful metaphor for when we think about our happiness, that should you become faint from lack of oxygen, you'll be no use to anybody else.
Your point about guilt, though.
Well, I just think that that women tend to feel guilty when they aren't perfect as in any number of domains, and that I suspect that men don't feel the same sort of guilt. So, you know, they show up to back to school night and feel like they're a really great father, and they know that they're doing more than their own fathers do, and that women's expectations for their parenting is taken to a whole nother level. So whether or not the men are doing as much or doing more than previous generations, they tend to feel better about their involvement at home. And, you know, I actually think if you look at these cultural changes over time, that could be one of the reasons why men are getting happier, because they are becoming more involved in their family lives in a way that doesn't create necessarily a lot of anxiety for them. And so their social, those are the most important social connections that you could imagine.
We're coming up on a break. I want to give out the phone number and invite you listeners to join this conversation. If you have some thoughts, please do, or questions. It's toll free, 866-733-6786, or send us an email, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Women are getting unhappier over recent decades, while men are getting happier. That's according to data from the General Social Survey, which has tracked women and American mood since 1972. And we're discussing the possible causes of, well, women's gloom, really, here. And Betsy Stevenson is with us, Assistant Professor of Business and Public Policy at the Wharton School of Business and co-author of the recent study, Paradox of Declining Female Happiness. And Christine Carter is here with us in studio, Executive Director of Greater Good Science Center and author of Raising Happiness, which will be out from Random House in January. And the Greater Good Science Center, as I said earlier, will be hosting a special day-long event at UC Berkeley tomorrow on the science of a meaningful life, forgiveness and gratitude. And you can find out more by simply going to greatergoodscience.org. Ruth Rosen with us from Berkeley this morning, professor of history at UC Berkeley and former columnist with the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. We'll find out what you, our listeners, think about all this and questions you might have. But Ruth Rosen, I wanted to just bring you back into the conversation and get your sense of, whether or not perhaps, again, expectations are part of the key here. That is, the institutions perhaps haven't kept up with what we need, as you've pointed out, for equity and to make women happier or to make them less unhappy. The culture hasn't kept up with it. But the expectations that came with the feminist movement may have come from a lot of bad journalism and tin ears and all that. But nevertheless, it's very real, those expectations, aren't they?
Yes, I really think the deepest, most profound reason for unhappiness, I mean, it's not the only, but the most profound is if you just take a woman who's just surfing, say, the television, and she sees one of these programs of how to, her house should look, one of these sort of, I call, house porn statements. And then there's another one about how she should look in clothes. Then there's another one on how her appearance should look and what kind of makeup she should be wearing and what kind of everything. And then what she should be achieving. All of these things are so unbelievable. She cannot, someone mentioned that she cannot be doing all those things and not feel like she's failed because she's not perfect, because no one can do all those things and be good at it. And I think what's so important is, you know, when the women's movement came out, if you think back, ironically, the women's movement was described as a bunch of ugly women, and when in fact, I know as a historian, the women's movement actually had an enormous number of really terrific-looking women, really gorgeous-looking women, but they didn't feel particularly like they had to dress up. In fact, they were rejecting the idea that their appearance was so important. They didn't want to look, have their appearance be the judgment of their value of their life. And while they started having aspirations and got very excited by that, they hadn't quite yet, and this is true of me, they hadn't quite yet put together, if I have an aspiration to do this, how is it going to all get done? And if you look at Helen Gurley Brown, she came out, I think, in 1979, 1980, was a very big year for articles and books that came out with the superwoman. I could not find one book or one article written by any feminist who ever wrote about the superwoman, that she should be so perfect. But there was a ton of articles by journalists who wrote about the superwoman. So there's a whole generation of young women who have grown up with this idea that they should have the perfect house, the perfect decorated house, the perfect interior design, the perfect body, the perfect clothes, the perfect achievement, and the perfect promotion, and so on. How can these women feel like they are even anything but a failure with all that perfection thrown at them?
They're also getting the message that they could be sexually equal with men and be just as adventurous and promiscuous.
Exactly.
When there are consequences untold. And I was listening to Drew Pinsky talking about how young women grow up watching Sex and the City, thinking, I can be like Samantha, you know.
Exactly.
And that's toxic. It's dangerous.
Right. And how many people are aware of all the consequences of Samantha's life? So, yes, I think these are all new. In the last 40 years, there would have never been someone like Samantha on any television show. All in the Family was what we had in 1972, not Samantha. And so, you know, we just had a daughter who was fighting with her father about the equality of the women's movement, talking about it in a rather abstract way, certainly not talking about it as sexual adventures equals equality. So, yes, things have changed. So,
unintended consequences of feminism, some might argue.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, to me, one of the big things that's changed is the expectations that you should be perfect at all these things.
Let me bring in our callers. Susan, first up, good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thank you. I wanted to speak really briefly because your show is speaking exactly about me and the high expectations we have for ourselves as women. And as a working mother who's actually sitting outside her office on the cell phone right now, I really wanted to talk to your listeners and speakers about how do we break out of this mold? I feel that several years ago I had quite a bit of a loss in my life, and that really kind of snapped everything into perspective, and I felt much happier after going through those experiences. However, it's so easy to slip back into this societal pressure of being the best mother, being the best worker, and achieving. And how do we break out of this mold?
Have some thoughts, Christine Carter?
Oh,
breaking out of the mold?
I'm sure you have lots of thoughts about that. I think all this talk about perfectionism is a great place to start, just in recognizing that perfectionism is a particular form of unhappiness that's fueled by a fear of disappointing, a fear of not reaching certain expectations, and that making a conscious effort to let go of trying to be perfect in any realm will lead to a lot more happiness. Now, I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that you experienced a lot of loss, and that actually made you happier, because I think that that paradox comes from what we were talking about earlier in terms of how our sense of entitlement or just the abundance in our life can lead to us feeling more disappointed when we don't get what we expect or when we don't get what we want versus gratitude when we do get what we want. So there's this interesting thing that's happening, that gratitude tends to be really connected to scarcity in some ways, that we feel really grateful when we get things that we aren't necessarily expecting. And so when we experience a big loss, it can open up certain realms of gratitude for us. And that one thing that we know that the science of happiness has told us is that people who are consciously practicing gratitude, whether or not they're experiencing some sort of scarcity or abundance, they tend to be a lot happier than people who aren't. So some of this is blazingly obvious in the sense that entitlement is not necessarily a form of happiness, and gratitude can be a happiness in and of itself.
Well, you mentioned the science of happiness, and I think we have to bring in set points here and wonder to some extent, and I'll just put it out there as a question because I think it's a question that we don't have all the answers to by any means, the difference in, well, biological structure, really, or chromosomal structure, or whatever, hormones, endocrinology, those kinds of things. I mean, there are different set points between men and women in terms of happiness, are there not?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of the set point assumptions that we've had from a scientific standpoint are being called more into question, because we're seeing a larger number of people be able to change what they assumed was a set point. So, of course, genetics come into play.
I'm not saying set points are inflexible, but they are. They do have certainly.
Well, yeah, and certainly for women, hormones can be a larger factor. But I actually think a greater factor is, or at least half, about half of our happiness can come from. I'm a sociologist, so I'm going to come.
Gratitude is the word you're savoring here. I understand that. We'll bring in some more calls, and Tristan, join us.
I'll jump in and actually say that I have the exact same view, which is my understanding of the literature is that about half of happiness can be attributed to some sort of biological set point factor, and about half is something that's a reaction to life events.
That's Betsy Stevenson. Thank you, Betsy. And let's hear from Tristan next. Tristan, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. Thank you for the call. So I recently read a book by Oliver, a child psychologist, and I'm just picking up on the point of...
We got a lousy line here, Tristan. I'm going to have to put you on hold and see if we can get a better line because you're breaking up, and let me go to another caller. We'll go to Jennifer next in the city. Hi, Jennifer.
Yes. Hi, Michael. I wanted to make a point about how expectations really, in more profound ways, have not changed. For example, on every talk show, in every book that I read, the logic, the argument for convincing women that they should take care of themselves, inevitably it comes back to do that so that you have something to give to others. And even just now we heard that from the guest about the oxygen mask, do that so that you have something to give. And that to me is still the old rationale. And for a woman, how do you know when you've done enough taking care of yourself so that you're ready to start giving again? I really think we need to move beyond that.
Is that paradigm not changed, Ruth Rosen? Is that accurate in your mind?
Well, I think the expectations have changed a great deal. For example, the the emphasis on becoming the perfect mom and listening to Mozart while baby is in utero and while the baby is all of the intensity of mothering and being and parental for men, too, that's rather recent. That was not going on in the 50s or in the 1960s. So this, I think there's a real change. And in some ways, if when you read books on cognitive therapy and depression, I'm so fascinated by the fact that they address the issue that the more people want to have perfect lives, perfect babies, perfect appearance, perfect home, perfect job and career, the less likely they are to be very good at it. That is, they're less likely to be not only perfect, but they're less likely to be really terrifically, except really wonderful at those things. And the person who's so perfectionist tends to be really have a big problem.
So be grateful and embrace your imperfections. That's the wisdom I'm hearing.
Well, I think actually, to tell you the truth, Michael, when I first started teaching as a young assistant professor, I'd go out of every lecture thinking, oh, my God, I really blew this. And you know what? Over years, I realized I never blow a lecture. You know, there's nothing that's like a one, but there's gradations. And I was so accustomed to thinking I had to be perfect.
Let me bring more of our callers. Jody joins us next. Jody, you're on. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. I appreciate the conversation that's been taking place. But I'm listening to it as a lesbian woman. I've been out since I was 13. I'm 37 now. And I'm trying to relate to this. And I got to tell you, I'm like, what? I have such a different perspective as a woman on the planet. Maybe it's because I've, you know, spent the majority of my life out and kind of pursuing what feels right and real for me. The other thing is that, you know, as far as the influences that come from the outside to try to generate perfection in us or encourage us or beat us into perfection, perfectionist approaches is, you know, some, I guess, personal responsibility. I find a lot of times we're like, how are we supposed to do this? How are you, you know, how, you know, what pill can I take? What book can I read? What psychologist should I listen to? You know, what food should I eat? You know, I'm thinking that maybe we need to kind of step back and say, what can I do right now in my own, within my own realm, take care of this and stop looking outside of us to the talk shows, you know, all the self-help books, the whatever, the Mozart, you know, book baby on raising the right baby, whatever, you know what I'm saying? It's
you're accepting this talk show, obviously, aren't you?
I'm trying to find some personal responsibility here, and I don't hear it. And maybe I'm being harsh on, you know, women, but, you know, I'm a woman, and I think it's important for me to take a critical look at us and say, what are we doing?
Well, you've raised two important issues. Let me go to Betsy Stevenson, first of all. And, do you know how many lesbians were queried in your survey?
That is not something, that's just not a question that's asked. So it would be, the survey is a representative group of the population. We capture over 40,000 people, so there are undoubtedly lesbians in the survey, but we're not able to identify them.
What about the question then that Jody raises about personal responsibility here, particularly when we're looking at unhappiness from, say, cultural, institutional standpoints and all of those factors?
Well, you know, what my work is doing is actually identifying trends and then trying to understand what's the cause behind them. You know, I would say that, you know, we have to ask the question then, is that a social trend? So have people become, say, less responsible? You know, has there been a decline in personal responsibility over the last 35 years? And has that decline in personal responsibility been different for men and for women? You know, that if that's the case, then that could possibly explain why women have become less happy. You know, I think that there are probably better explanations out there, though, for what's going on.
Well, let me thank Jody, and I will move on to more calls, but I want to move on to some emails, and you can email us forum@kqed.org. Olivia writes, how much of this debate can be attributed to the discrepancy between how far women have moved into traditionally male roles over how far men have moved into traditionally female roles? Women are now expected to do it all, however. Men do not seem to have the same increase in expectations. Ginny writes, one thing I haven't heard discussed yet, though women have more rights and legal protections, the reality of equality does not yet match the rhetoric and what we're told as we grow up. What's difficult now is that you're told you have reached a level of equality, and yes, it is, of course, better, and you expect that you can achieve what you want in the workplace, career, but the reality is women are still not treated or respected in the same way for the same work. Facing the reality of that every day is difficult and oftentimes truly disheartening. It goes the same for the home front. Although men do contribute more, I don't think it's a big mystery who, on the average, still bears the majority of responsibility. And Mark writes, it seems that to expect society to change to fit an image of what one thinks it should be is a route to unhappiness. It's fine to work for what you believe in, but unless you detach from the outcome, you'll be perennially disappointed. Marika says, girls and young women get so much attention and so many perks that boys and young men don't. Perhaps men get happier as they age because they don't feel the gradual loss of youthful advantage in the way that women do. And another listener wants to know, did the guests include all industrialized countries? I believe women in Europe are happier because of more support in the workplace for mothers and more time to enjoy life. Betsy Stevenson, can I get you a comment on that?
Yeah, so we actually did look at data in Europe, and that's actually one of the things that really contributes to this being a puzzle, is that women have become less happy in Europe relative to men. Now, it is the case that Europeans have become happier over time, but what's happened, if you break that apart by men and women, what you see is that there's been large increases in happiness among European men and much smaller or even non-existent increases in happiness for European women. So again, these gains seem to be going to men, and that's true whether we're looking at the Netherlands, Spain, Portugal, France, countries that have had very different experiences with the women's movement.
And I'm sorry.
And that really raises makes it harder for us to understand what's going on. Why is it something that's so ubiquitous?
Well, it is a puzzle, as you say, and we're getting all kinds of suggestions about the cause for this effect. Laura, one of our listeners, writes, the show seems to be focused on women and their careers. I think it should be mentioned that women may be more affected than men by the larger world issues such as global warming and human suffering. Is it possible that women are inherent nurturers and consequently feel the weight of impending doom more deeply than men? These large world issues cannot be ignored when speaking about individual happiness.
That's absolutely right. That's actually something that we really emphasize, is that these broader social trends can be affecting women more than they're affecting men.
And we'll have more of our callers on. Mandy, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm interested to hear about how single women's happiness compares to married women. I recall a study coming out last year that said that single women were indeed happier. And as a 38-year-old single woman with no intention to marry, I find that I get to live the life I want to live, and I find great joy in that.
It's nice to hear from a happy woman. Betsy Stevenson, how much can we quantify marriage versus non-marriage? I know women with children are supposedly the unhappiest, but
well, it's actually people with children, whether you're men or women. But actually, married people, both men and women, married people tend to be happier than single people. But you know, it's very hard for us to understand the causal relationship, particularly when it comes to marriage, because what we've seen in the data, if we look at longitudinal data, is that people marry happy people. So it's not that you become happier when you get married, it's that the happy people are more likely to get married than the unhappy people. And so we see a big difference with married people on average happier than single people, but it's hard to know whether that's causal.
Well, and there are a lot more widows than widowers. I mean, just statistically, women live longer. But let's get Kevin on next from Belmont. Kevin, hi.
Hi, yeah. One of the things I was wondering about, Dr. Rosen mentioned the focus of the women's movement on systemic change and enabling women to be able to have richer lives. But reading Sharon Smith's book, Women and Socialism, one of the things that it seemed to indicate was that there was a significant chunk of the women's movement that it kind of got a lot of the headlines, sort of the power feminist movement of, you know, they're sort of really focused more on the realities of maybe middle-class women than, say, working women. And, you know, that I'm wondering if there could be class differences, you know, middle-class women having access to private child care and better health care and so forth, whether the stresses on that working women are getting are going to be less in that situation, especially given the buildup of working hours and so forth over the last 30 years. So
it's a good question, Kevin, an important one. Not only class differences, but Ruth Rosen, I'll go to you on this. Also, one might add economic differences. You remember Lenora Weitzman's work about how single women, as the feminist movement burgeoned, became, well, less economically able to do what they thought they were able to do,
well,
women who were
right.
Divorced, yeah.
And first of all, there was a lot of incorrect information about who was part of the women's movement. Most of the women who joined groups looked like they were middle class because they'd gone to college and they were white-skinned.
And a lot of them were the first person who had ever gone to college, and what they gained by going to college was the poise of a middle-class woman who was speaking out of disappointment of what they were now expecting. The second thing is that there was a real belief, if you think back to some of the slogans, sisterhood is powerful, if we're not free, if we're all not free, there was a general, and it was vague, but a general sense that collective systemic changes needed to be made, there needed to be childcare on site, and so forth. In other words, you can't, it's not up to you to do it all. And I think the pressure for women to have to do this by themselves or to think about it as a personal problem to which they have to find the solution is an unbearable one. I think that's a tremendous source of unhappiness.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Ruth Rosen, with Betsy Stevenson, and with Christine Carter, and it's Fall Pledge on KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Let me go back to you, Christine Carter, if I may, and ask how much just, well, things like health care and having the kind of benefits that one thinks of, for example, in many European cultures where women are concerned, is a key to happiness or is a central kind of foundation for happiness.
Yeah, well, we do know that our physical health is really highly correlated with happiness and emotional well-being. And so to the extent that we are healthy, that can lead to greater happiness, certainly. And, you know, one thing is stress is something that can really deteriorate our health. So we've been talking about women and what their lives are like now. And if you are under a lot of chronic stress, of course, over the life course, you're going to become a little bit less healthy because that stress will take a toll physically on you. And that could really be something that is affecting people's happiness. Now, you know, the other thing that we haven't really touched on is friendships and women's friendships can affect their physical health and also their mental well-being as well. And so when we talk about what people can do to lead happier lives, it's sort of counter these trends where women are spending less time with their friends. I would say go out. If you want to be healthier and happier, go spend more time with your friends. Get to know your neighbors.
Well, here's Julie who writes, we haven't talked about loss of community with women. My mother, I'm 35, was a stay-at-home mom and had a whole community of friends in her neighborhood and church. Now we see a whole generation of women who are separated from other women, I think essential for us because of career and business and lack of opportunity. Many women need a collective experience and true friends to be happy, I believe. And then you were talking about, again, emotional and stress-related things. And Richard in Carson City says, it's important not to confuse unhappiness, which is cognitive, with depression, which is emotional. Emotions are hormonal, and hormones are a function of nutrition. Anyone with a low omega-3 index will struggle with depression. Everybody has these kind of easy answers. reductive, though they may be, they are important. Kevin writes, it's hard to believe that women, rather than have a greater amount of societal pressure to achieve great things. Man's worth is solely and relentlessly judged on his outward achievements, and there simply isn't room enough at the top for all men. Most men go through life feeling like losers for this reason. Mark says, I found your guest's cause-effect interpretations of the survey quite insightful, but aren't we just reflecting on responses and not actual states of happiness? There's a big difference between the two, and the former may blind us to the latter. Lisa says, I'd like to hear comments on the expectation that you have to be a mother, and if you don't want to be a mother, there is something wrong with you. Betsy Stevenson, did you give me data on that?
Well, you know, we don't have any data on how other people view parenthood, but as I said, we certainly see in the data that that people with kids are less happy than people without kids. You know, when you are comparing people in similar circumstances, and it doesn't matter, you know, whether we're looking at people who have kids young versus people who have kids old, and a lot of people also come back and say, well, maybe when the kids are grown, you're happier, you know, now that you've got these adult, wonderful kids. But even then, when we're looking at people in their 60s and older, we still don't see that people who had kids. Certainly, I wouldn't say that people should feel pressure to have children because the data doesn't indicate that they should have children, according to happiness. Yet, I also think that this happiness data perhaps points to the limitation of asking people about their subjective well-being in terms of happiness, that maybe there's something greater than happiness, like fulfillment, that these questions simply aren't capturing. And this is actually one of my concerns with thinking about the limitations of the data, is that very few people I've ever talked to said that they wish they hadn't had children, and yet the majority of people, on average, are less happy when they do have children. And I think this is a real puzzle.
Angelica, let's get you on before we wrap things up here. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. First of all, the conversation this morning really touched the nerve for me as I make my hour commute. My corporate counsel position as the sole 31-year-old single woman working in a field of men predominantly. I think the idea of perfectionism touches me on a daily basis, where I think the broader picture is that we women who sort of reach a certain point in education or in professional achievement are compelled to be not just good or not just pretty good at what we do, but to be better than our colleagues, meaning our male colleagues, at what we do. Otherwise, we're sort of discarded and not regarded as being sort of consummate professionals or being really profoundly special. And I think that message is relayed to us from the time we're young girls. I mean, they never just tell us, you know, it's all right to go to college and get a nice job after and make an average amount of money and hang out with, you know, your friends and family. That's never the message.
I think, Angelica, your message is a good one to wrap up with here. I mean, that importance, again, of early development and of too much emphasis on perfectionism. I think we've learned a great deal this hour. I want to thank Betsy Stevenson, who is co-author of The Study Paradox of Declining Female Happiness, and Ruth Rosen, author of The World Split Open, a professor of history at UC Berkeley, and Christine Carter, executive director of the Greater Good Science Center. Thanks to all of you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And next, Corinne Armstrong joins us in studio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.